Now, bring it up big. Now, what do you think of that? Now, that is big-time Jew's harp playing. And in case you... it's amazing how the audience is split. Right smack down the middle. That either people think that's an abomination, and they say, yeah, quit playing that rotten, ridiculous, obscene toy, Shepard. You're too intelligent for that. Please stop playing it immediately, or I, as a regular listener, will refuse to listen to you any longer. Blah, blah, blah. Then there's the other kind who relates so totally with the Jew's harp that they almost vibrate physically like a tuning fork. Whenever they hear the sound of a Jew's harp being played in the middle distance, it just splits right. I have never known anything that is as truly controversial. Now, Herb, I want to show you another kind of a another sort of Jew's harp that is again. It's almost the obvious reversal of the Sicilian style, and I'm not attempting here to. To give you a guided tour of the Jew's harp as an instrument. But here, Herb, what cut do you have on there? Okay, let's hear it. I'll see what we can do. All right, here we go. That's another time. Completely different style. And, I guess we here in America are kind of innocent in what could be called art. I suspect that we're still vaguely emerging from the frontier life, and for that reason we still think things like Campbell soup cans are really great art. we're quite innocent, and I'll never forget the day that I had the great awakening. Speaking of an art form, and even yet in this country, there are just very few people who recognize this next art form I'm going to talk about as an art form. And it is, I suspect that quite possibly maybe 500 years from now. That they may look back on our time, I'm talking about our century, and there will be preserved examples of this great form which we created, And I have a feeling, too, that at any time in any given century, the art form of that century that's really important is not often recognized by the people of that time as being that important. It's just sort of functional. It's just there, you know, and they've created this thing and they just kind of accept it. For example, back in the days of people like Michelangelo and so on, when they were doing their great church art, I don't think the people of that period really recognized it as it'd be a thing that millions of people would eventually come to see, and it's kind of the top art of that whole Renaissance period. It's the important statement. They just looked upon it as part of their religion. It was just accepted that way. And many of the artists of that period were not even considered artists, really. They were just considered like carpenters, artisans. And they would be hired to come in and do this church, and the people would pay him, and he would go his way. And just like today, we hire an electrician. He comes in, he does his work, and that's the end of it. We hire a painter. He comes in and paints the building, and he leaves. Many people think of architects that way. An architect will come, and they say, I want you to design this porch we want to put on the side here. He's an artisan. He comes, he tells you how many 2x4s you need, and he makes this sketch, and he may have really created something that, you know, 100 years from now, people are going to look at and say, how beautiful, look at that stark simplicity, look at that functional statement, why we don't do things like this anymore, that kind of thing. Well, there's a lot to that. Let's take people like stonemasons, for example. But back in the early 19th century, the late 17th century, when these carvings appeared, when people would decorate their buildings, particularly in places like Paris and throughout Europe, you'd see these great, fantastic, magnificent gargoyles and these tremendous things. Well, the guys that did these things never considered themselves sculptures or anything. They were stonemasons. So they'd get an order for 500 gargoyles. Seven allegorical figures, and the guy would take his chisel and he'd whack out seven allegorical figures. And now, today, people are going for, you know, hundreds of miles to photograph these things, and they're turning out books on them. And I suspect that we're also, and have, created a form which is now rapidly in decline, but we did create a form at one point around the mid part of the 20th century. Actually, it was earlier than that. I would say in the early quarter of the 20th century, a new form was created, and it existed briefly for about 10 or 12 years in its really flowering form, and then it began to decline, as all art forms do. They ultimately decline. And I'll never forget. Now, do you have that cut that John brought in? Now, hold it there for a second. When I discovered this form, up to that point, I'd been walking around ignorant. And I, in large part, am today. But one day, a friend of mine, this was in Cincinnati, I was going to school out there, and I had a job, and I was doing things, and just beginning to see that there was more to the world than Flash Gordon. There was more to drawing than, say, Prince Valiant. And I was just beginning to suspect things. You know, we go through this period when we begin to see things that we never really realize. It's like the world is a giant iceberg, and the first few years of our life, we only see a little tiny bit of it sticking up on the top, and then we begin to see how fantastically varied and infinitely complex it is. And I suppose that's called maturation. But nevertheless, I was going through this period, and this friend of mine, whom I didn't really know too well, I shouldn't call him a friend, he was just sort of an acquaintance, but he sure turned me on to a thing. I'll never forget him for that. And he was an odd-looking guy, tall, skinny guy with totally bald. He shaved his head. It wasn't that he was bald. He just shaved his head. And he had a curious, stark quality to him. He must have been 6 feet four. And he was kind of lean, laconic type. And I just knew him sort of casually from around school. It was the University of Cincinnati. And I just knew him casually. And one day, he was a teacher there, and of course, being a teacher, he had a certain aura about him. And one day, we got talking on a Friday afternoon. He says, "Listen, we got discussing something," and he said, "Are you really curious to see? You really want to see something?" And I said, "Yeah." And an odd look came in his eye. He said, "Well, I'll tell you what you do. You be at this address tomorrow at 11 o'clock in the morning. And he says, any of you in the class want to see this? And two or three hands went up, and he says, you come out over 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. And he says, and I'll see you at this address. And so the next Saturday I woke up and I thought, well, I at first I thought maybe I wouldn't go. And then I said, oh, well, what the heck, you know, not much to do Saturday morning. So, and I was off and I didn't have any work or anything. So I got my Ford and I drove over to this place. I had this battered old Ford. And it turned out to be a garage. Just a plain, ordinary, crummy-looking garage standing there. Nothing except a couple of swinging doors and a couple of shady-looking windows with tape over them. And outside of it was this guy, Woody. And the three or four of us gathered, and he says, okay. He says, now do you really want to see something? He says, I want to prepare you for this. He says, first of all, it's like nothing you've ever seen before. And we didn't know what to expect. He played it very well and theatrically. And so he says, okay, all right. He says, all right, you ready? And he takes his key ring out with a lot of keys, and he opens the lock on this garage door. It was a big four-car garage. And he swings the doors open, just swings them open. And the four of us walked into the gloom of this garage on a gray Saturday morning in Cincinnati. And I couldn't believe what I saw. It was that unreal. I couldn't believe it. And he reached up and he flicked on a neon light, another kind they have in garages, these long blue-looking argon-type freon lights, which made it even more spectacular. He flicked it on, and all of a sudden, this thing began to gleam with that light. And there it was. And from that time on, my aesthetics have never been the same. I mean, it's like if all of your life you believe that Sneaky Pete is the greatest tasting drink you ever had, and then all of a sudden you run into a fine French vintage year wine. There ain't no going back. Ain't no way to go back to Tab and Pepsi-Cola after one has tasted the outpouring of the Imperium Springs. There it was. And I'll venture to say not more than one out of 15 of you, even though, even when I tell you what it is, even have any faint idea of what I'm talking about. Not that you're, you know, stupid or anything, but you probably just haven't come into contact with it in the right way. We were looking at one of the great automobiles in the world. I mean, one of the great automobiles. By great, this car had appeared in probably 200 or 300 catalogs of great masterworks. That specific car. Even today, that car is a... Even today, that car is almost priceless. It was one of the finest works of one of the great artists of the 20th century. Considered one, possibly his prime work. A Torta Bugatti. Did you ever hear the name? A Torta Bugatti. The maestro. The man who created automobiles the way Michelangelo created altar cloths. He created them as works of art. And there, resting on the floor, under that flickering neon light, was a dark, rich, plum-colored 57 SC. One of the great moments in the career of a Torta Bugatti. An automobile that had been created expressly for a French duke. Late in the 1930s, around 1937, a car built specifically for mountain driving. A lithe, magnificent, evil, sensual-looking machine that lay low. It didn't really squat on the floor, it just sort of lounged there, stretching out low and flat, sensual. And looking at that car, you felt flight in every inch of it. Not only flight, but movement and statement. And a curious kind of truth. It was so honest. It was a car. But it was a car the way you would never conceive of cars being. The difference between a Toyota Bugatti 57 SC and what we would consider a beautiful car today is the difference between one of these dollar coffee mugs that you buy at Woolworths with a picture of Donald Duck on the side to a silver chalice turned out by Botticelli to add style to the life of a Venetian Grand Duke. A great world, a whole cultural world. In fact, it sort of spanned time that Ettore Bugatti was a Renaissance artist who somehow had been reincarnated in the 20th century. And he lived in a baronial style, as a great artist should, and he had helpers and devoted assistants who worshipped the ground he walked on. His factory was in France, not in Italy, but in France. And the Bugatti Enclave is legend today among people who know anything about 20th century art. And every car was turned out with the kind of care, love, and total artistry that, say, a Rembrandt would turn out his work. And incidentally, a Rembrandt also had his apprentices who would fill in the background and deal with the little details. Or did you know that? Oh, yes. And so Bugatti, Ettore Bugatti, created this fantastic master, and I had never heard of him. I just knew there was a thing called foreign cars. I didn't realize that there was one man to whom a car was not a car, and he spoke in a universal language. It was an art, pure and simple. Ettore Bugatti. Now, you want to hear a little more about Bugatti? Some of his great cars. You know, to throw in a... So, you know, we're not used to thinking of the car as an art form. We're used to thinking of there are beautiful cars. We think of there's a great-looking, maybe a classic car and so on. But we're not used to thinking of the car as an art form. But for a long time, as considerably longer than we have, the Europeans have recognized it as such. It is an art form. And unfortunately, it's an art form that is in decline. This is not anything to do with nostalgia. It has to do with the changing world, that the car has become a utilitarian object, pure and simple. It wasn't always that way. And when Bugatti created his cars, it was the day when dukes, duchesses, kings, rajas, maharajas, viscounts, field marshals, Ali Khans, people of that kind, when they wanted an automobile, when they wanted a car, they treated the car like the rest of their life. If they wanted a fine home, they didn't just go out and buy something off the gas pipe racks. There would be a fine home, a chateau would be created for them. Their suits were done that way. If you were a Maharaja, you would travel to Savile Row in London. 7,000-8,000 miles by boat, and finally you would arrive at your tailor, Bond Street possibly, and he would create a wardrobe for you, and it would take months. You wouldn't just go there and get fitted. he would create a wardrobe, and so it would take months of fitting, and he would stay there. He would stay in a magnificent suite at a hotel in London while he was being fitted. Well, his car was really a carriage. when he was out, this automobile was not a car, really. It was not a means of transportation. It was that, of course, but it was an extension of his personality, like everything else. And so Ettore Bugatti, this great artist, would create a car specifically for the man involved. And by the way, money wasn't the criterion. So if you were a big bootlegger from Chicago, you couldn't just go over to France and talk to Ettore Bugatti and say you would like a car. Not like, you know, today. It's money. You buy a car and that's it. It doesn't make any difference who you are. If you want to buy a Rolls, you can buy a Rolls Royce. Not a Bugatti. Many people were turned down by the maestro. And all cars were ordered personally. You didn't go to your Bugatti dealer and order a car, any more than you went to your Rembrandt dealer and ordered a Rembrandt painted up. Yeah, and so if you came to the enclave there and he didn't like the way you were, he didn't feel that you were fit to be driving a Bugatti, you just simply did not get a Bugatti. That was all there was to it. He would suggest perhaps an Isotta Fraccini would be more suitable to you, possibly a Maserati, but certainly not a Bugatti. Now, here's a quote, a little writing about Mr. Bugatti. This is called The Bugatti Mystique, and it's from a book. I collect literature on automobiles, and this is a fine little book. And I don't think anybody's really yet done in a serious way. I wish some really serious biographer, instead of an automobile cuckoo, would do the life and times of Ettore Bugatti, because he is such a symbolic figure, such a fantastic figure. And it would take somebody who's a really top biographer who dealt with Bugatti the way you would deal with, say, a Picasso, or you would deal. And incidentally, he's very much in the same league. He is in the same league. don't you forget it. But I would say that 1,000 years from now, Bugattis will be in museums just the way Picasso paintings are, and for the same reason, for their artistic values. Here's what they say. Perhaps the most fascinating feature of the mystique which surrounds Ettore Bugatti and his automobile designs is the way it attracts men and some women of all ages as no other contemporary or even later creation manages to do. Elderly men recall the excitement of their youth, but something else appeals to the young man who was born when the car and even Bugatti himself were no more. The aesthetic appeal of his cars, especially the engines and the radiator shape, is undoubtedly a factor. To lift up the hood or bonnet of a Bugatti is to delight the eye with every sense. The shiny, rectangular, magnificently contrived shapes of the blocks, the cam boxes, the curving complications of inlet and exhaust manifolds, the interesting, subtly sinister ribbing of the blower casing, externally four large narrow wheels at the corners, the stark horseshoe radiator with the depth of gleam that comes from polished German silver. They use silver in their radiators without the excessive brilliance of nickel. See, he didn't like nickel. Was too shiny. His works are all contrived to please the eye. German silver without the excess brilliance of nickel or the blueness of chromium plating, set in line with the front axle, a long, tapered, subtly tapered, louvered bonnet tapering subtly back, the walnut-rimmed steering wheel of exactly the right proportions. Everything was perfectly thought of in aesthetics. And behind, either a short pointed tail in the Grand Prix or Grand Sport models, and that's the one I saw, or some fine example of the coach builder's art on most of the touring models. All of these and much more detail combine to totally delight the eye, even when the eye has absolutely no interest in the mechanical parts. And that's the point. You don't have to care about cars to be excited by a Bugatti. If part of the mystique arises from this aesthetic stimulus, a further factor must surely be the total performance of Bugatti cars. See, he also believed in them running. Except an occasional model where the master erred, like all other artists, he had his bad days. Many find the noise itself appealing. The strange, subtle whir of the engine. The sharp, angry bark of the exhaust, which arises from Bugatti's lifelong preoccupation with large exhaust valves and piping. The road holding and steering are, of course, superb. With special tread compounds and so on, these cars will stand by any contemporary design. A Type 57 is a bit harsh when driven over rough French roads, and a GP appallingly so. But in terms of speed and acceleration, a few Bugatti models can look most modern in the face and so on. But the point is that the Bugatti has slowly gotten to be a total mystique. If you've never seen a Bugatti or know what a Bugatti is, there's no way for me to describe a Bugatti except by the use of that particular quote. And he turned out comparatively few automobiles. Naturally, they were all hand-built, and they turned out very, very briefly. And his cars dominated the tracks, too. They were great racing machines. They dominated the tracks of their period for a time. And whenever the Bugattis were running, of course, people came from thousands of miles just to hear them and to see them go by. The famous 35 Cs, which is a classic Bugatti racing type, is still today one of the most sought-after cars. And every Bugatti, the Bugatti Owners Association of the World, every known Bugatti is cataloged. So there's no way for you to go find a Bugatti in the junkyard. If you do, it's like finding a Vermeer that nobody knew about. In fact, they've even gotten the old factory records, and they've found out where every car which he built in his time, where it was delivered, and they've traced down what happened to it, just like any work of art, through various owners, and that eventually some of them disappeared, just like many art, you know, like many paintings do. It disappeared, was lost in a fire, or it was lost in a crash, or one thing and another. And so today, every Bugatti in the world is on file somewhere. And the Bugatti Club has it's really not a club, it's kind of like a devoted monastic order, and they devote themselves to keeping this thing. They're preserving the works of the master. And if Bugatti doesn't get his ultimate just due, I mean, as a great artist of the 20th century, a wider just due, you see. It's curious that he worked in one of the most popular forms of all time, the automobile, and yet his name is very little known among, you know, the average person, even people who like art. I would suspect that the average museum art goer doesn't know the name Bugatti. And yet his name should stand next to Brancusi, who also worked in modern steel forms and so on. Ettore Bugatti. Now, I don't know why I particularly felt like doing this show tonight, except that I was sitting in my office, and I had this volume of a work about Bugatti. If you'd like to see it, I think it's it's Ballantine's Illustrated History of the Car series, Mark Book Number 1. The first one they did was Bugatti, and it's a dollar book. I don't know where you can get copies of it, but you can read a little bit about this, and you can see pictures of his fantastic automobiles and the strange mystique that developed around the whole world of Bugatti. But I would venture to say that the average person today who really feels he knows art, I mean, who does, too, does not know the name of Ettore Bugatti, the great golden bug. Bugatti, B-U-G-A-T-T-I, the maestro.